gym, walk in, look around, and see how I feel. About 95% of the time, this set of cues will put me in a sufficiently energetic mood to go ahead and exercise, and that, in turn, boosts my mood. But sometimes, and this happened perhaps 5 times this year, which is typical, I get to the gym, look around, turn, and leave. As I drive home, I am not thinking I failed. In fact, I feel exactly the opposite. Failure is for people who have goals. If my goal is to exercise, leaving the gym without breaking a sweat looks and feels like failure. But what I have is not a goal. It is a system. And the system allows leakage. It is designed that way. As I drive home from the gym, a seemingly wasted trip, I never feel defeated. Instead, I feel I am using a system that I know works overall. I win if I exercise, and I win, albeit less, if I use my system and decide not to. Either way, my attitude improves. And at least I get out of the house and clear my head. It's all good. Don't be concerned about how much or how little you exercised on a given day. All that matters in the long run is that you made exercise a daily habit. Studies indicate that moderate levels of exercise are actually the best for longevity. Over time, you'll naturally gravitate toward adding the variety and challenge that your body can handle. Hair care death spiral. In 2011, the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Regina M. Benjamin, made headlines by saying too many women were skipping exercise because of hair-related issues. In her view, this qualified as an important health issue. The New York Times quoted Benjamin as saying, "Oftentimes you get women saying, 'I can't exercise today because I don't want to sweat my hair back or get my hair wet.'" When you're starting to exercise, you look for reasons not to, and sometimes the hair is one of those reasons. Dr. Benjamin's observations match my own, and yours too, I would imagine. I don't think I need to explain why putting your hair above your health is a loser strategy in the long run. If you're a woman caught in the hair care death spiral, nothing I've said in this book will be much help unless you escape. Allow me to offer a possible solution. I'm going to start with the assumption that there are 3 main reasons women want great-looking hair. 1, to attract sexual partners. 2, to improve career potential. And 3, to feel good about themselves. Everyone is different, but those 3 causes probably cover 85% of the reasons. The first 2 reasons, sexual partners and career options, are about influencing how others view you. And I would argue that feeling good about yourself has meaning only because you know you are influencing others to feel the same way. So really, hair care is about influencing how other people feel about you. We're all social animals, so there's nothing wrong with that. The world works only when we care how other people think. On the topic of women's hair, I can speak only from a heterosexual man's perspective. I encourage you to check with the men in your life for confirmation. My best guess is that what I say next is as near a universal opinion as men can have. We prefer you healthy. I've never known a man who would prefer an unhealthy-looking woman with movie star hair over a fit woman with a ponytail. And if I ever do meet that guy, I'll try to avoid him, because he sounds like a creep. A hiring manager will always have a subconscious bias for the healthier-looking applicant, male or female. Humans evolved to have favorable opinions about anyone who looks healthy because it's a marker for good reproductive odds. That's why society needs laws that limit discrimination against the differently abled. If your main reason for spending time on your hair is to feel good about yourself, a healthy body will always trump a good hairdo. I won't pretend to understand the minds of women when it comes to hair, and every woman is different. Some women are 3 different people before lunchtime. But I can tell you with certainty that men prefer you to be in good health, even if it means we miss the best of your hair potential. I would imagine it is very hard to break a hair care routine that has been part of your life for years, but it might help to think of things in a different way. If you skip exercise because of your hair, remind yourself during those many hours of brushing, curling, straightening, and drying that the long-term payoff for your efforts is to become less attractive, less employable, and less healthy. When you change how you think, it eventually changes how you behave. Having great hair is a short-term goal. Fitness is a system. Systems are for winners. Chapter 33. Voice Update 2. 3 years had passed since I lost my voice. It was getting hard to imagine it could ever be fixed. Outwardly, my life looked to be on track. Dilbert was running in over 2,000 newspapers in 65 countries. I'd married Shelley and we'd started building a home. Externally, things were great, but on the inside, I was badly damaged. My optimism was getting its ass kicked 24 hours a day, but somehow it still had a pulse. The simplest things in life were a terror. Every time the phone rang, my heart sank. Every time someone asked a question, I died a little on the inside. Emotionally, it was confusing. Half of my life was great, while half was darkly broken. I continued doing my affirmation, "I, Scott, will speak perfectly," but I was running out of potential remedies to try. My future looked bleak. One day, a Google alert showed up in my email inbox that looked promising. A doctor in Japan was reporting success treating spasmodic dysphonia with a surgical procedure on the neck. I was willing to fly to Japan if necessary. I would have swum there if I had to. By now, I had experienced so many disappointments in my search for a cure that Shelley couldn't muster much enthusiasm for my new long-shot hope. I know she didn't enjoy seeing me get my hopes up, and hers as well, just to be thrown against the rocks time and time again. Following protocol, I took the news of this new operation to my regular doctor, Dr. Smith, who referred me to my ear-nose-throat doctor, Dr. Cornelius Janssen III. Dr. Janssen hadn't yet heard of this new surgery, and he was concerned that the reports of success might be exaggerated. He explained that some reports of medical breakthroughs are more credible than others, and I shouldn't assume that this report was accurate. I wasn't surprised. Realistically, how likely is it that you can fix a brain abnormality by rigging up some sort of workaround in the neck? It sounded iffy even to me. But in the interest of exploring every option, Dr. Janssen recommended I speak to one of the top professionals in the field, Dr. Edward Damrose of the Otolaryngology Department of the Stanford School of Medicine. Dr. Damrose was familiar with the reports coming from Japan, but he suggested I contact a doctor closer to home who was pioneering a different type of surgery for spasmodic dysphonia. He referred me to Dr. Gerald Burke at the UCLA Medical Center. I got off the phone with Dr. Damrose feeling puzzled. How could there be a surgical fix for this condition that I hadn't heard about until now? How could this be true if there was no mention of it on the Internet on the sites that are dedicated specifically to this question? The only explanation I could imagine was that this would be another false lead and another dead end. But my system was to follow all leads, no matter how ridiculous or unlikely. I made an appointment with Dr. Burke for an initial visit and flew from my home near San Francisco to Los Angeles to meet with him. Dr. Burke is an interesting character, brilliant, confident, and a little bit mysterious. A small herd of doctors from other practices followed him from room to room to learn his ways. Dr. Burke and his tag-along doctors examined me and confirmed the diagnosis of spasmodic dysphonia. Then he explained that he had been perfecting a surgery for this condition over the past several years with about an 85% success rate, which in this context meant the patient had a better voice after surgery than before. Not a perfect voice, but substantially improved. Unfortunately, some people got worse after surgery, losing what little was left of their voices. But Dr. Burke had a good idea why some patients were less successful, and he was refining his technique to account for it. But here's the interesting part. Dr. Burke's surgery involved opening the front of the neck, cutting the nerves that lead from the brain to the vocal cords, and building a new path using nerves borrowed from elsewhere in the neck. Once the rewiring was done, the patient waited 3.5 months until the new nerve pathways regenerated and the voice came back. Until then, the brain and the vocal cords wouldn't be connected. There were no follow-up visits to the doctor. It either worked or it didn't. Does that sound like the way you fix a brain abnormality? It didn't sound like a logical solution to me, so I asked for a list of past patients as references. I was hopeful, but skeptical. The operation didn't make sense to me, and I was still scratching my head as to why none of this had appeared on the internet yet. I emailed some of Dr. Burke's patients and set up times to speak with them, if you can call it that, by phone. This was the one group of folks I could speak to confidently on the phone because they were skilled at deciphering my broken, raspy attempts at words, and they also understood that the call was mostly about their doing the talking. And talk they did. Perfectly. Not one of them had a hitch or a hesitation in their words. There was no hoarseness or clipped syllables. Each described the recovery from the operation as unpleasant because they choked nearly every time they tried to eat or drink for quite some time. But they were unanimous in saying it was worth it. Obviously, I was talking only to the lucky people who'd had the best results, but I was feeling good about this possibility. Still, I needed to satisfy my curiosity about one thing. I asked Dr. Burke how he'd figured out that nerve surgery in the neck could fix a brain abnormality. What evidence had he seen that others had not? His answer fascinated me. I suppose it explains why doctors follow him around. I'm paraphrasing, but Dr. Burke explained that it was an inspiration that somehow emerged from the sum of his knowledge about necks and throats and voices and nerves and all the rest. He didn't call it genius, but if this surgery worked, no other description would fit quite as well. If I decided to do the surgery, there was something on the order of a 15% chance my voice would not improve. And in that scenario, the surgery itself might eliminate the chance that I could benefit from some future treatment. It was a one-way trip to a destination unknown. I scheduled the surgery. Chapter 34. Luck. Let's talk about the elephant in the room when it comes to any discussion of success. Luck. My worldview is that all success is luck if you track it back to its source. Steve Jobs needed to both be born with Steve Jobs' DNA and meet a fellow named Steve Wozniak. If Bill Gates had been born where I was born, he would have been shooting woodchucks on weekends to help the local dairy farmers instead of learning to program computers. Warren Buffett makes a similar observation about his own skills, saying, in effect, that if he had been born in an earlier time, his natural talents wouldn't have matched the opportunities. My worldview is that every element of your personality, from your perseverance to your risk tolerance to your ambition to your intelligence, is a product of pure chance. You needed the genes you were born with and the exact experiences of your life to create the person you are with the opportunities you have. Every decision you make is a simple math product of those variables. What good is a book that discusses success if success is entirely luck? That's a perfectly reasonable thing to wonder. And it matters because if you believe all success is based on luck, you're not likely to try as hard as if you believe success comes from hard work. No matter what genes and circumstances you have, history tells us you still need to work hard to pull it off. Does a belief in pure luck work against you? It can, but it doesn't need to. This book has just become part of your experience. If I did my job right, some parts of it will repeat in your head and be reinforced by your own observations. As with any experience, you can't help but be changed by a book, if only a trivial amount. But everyone is different. One book can have a profound effect on one person and a tiny impact on another. In the coming year, assuming you've made it through this entire book, notice how many times you are reminded of something I wrote. Is there a time you don't feel like exercising, but you remember my trick of putting on your exercise clothes anyway? Do you steer clear of simple carbs for lunch because you've noticed they make you sleepy during the day? Are you looking for ways to turn your failures into something good? You wouldn't buy a book if it didn't have the potential to change you in some way, even if that change is just entertainment or an increase in your knowledge. Books change us automatically, just as any experience does. And if a book helps you see the world in a more useful way or amps up your energy level, it becomes part of the fabric of your personal luck. You're a different person now than you were when you started this book, literally. Some of your cells have died and been replaced. Your body has matured, even if only by a few hours, and your brain has modified its internal structure based on its chemistry and all of your outside influences, including what you've heard here. If anything in this book sticks in your mind, it will probably get reinforced over time. You're a new person now. You don't need to do anything as a result of listening to this book. You've already changed. And if I've done my job right, you've changed in a way that will someday make people say you were lucky. Chapter 35. Calendar Tree Startup. At the same time I was creating Dilbert Comics and writing this book, I was working with partners on a startup called CalendarTree.com. It's a website that helps you create a list of upcoming events and share a link so members of your team or group can add the events to their calendars with a few keystrokes. Our main selling point is that CalendarTree works across Google's, Microsoft Outlook's, and Apple's calendars. If your family is juggling a lot of team/sport/activity/work schedules from different sources, CalendarTree can be a huge help. At the time of this writing, the beta version is being readied for launch. I have no idea how successful the company will be because luck will surely play a big role. But the project serves as a good framework for showcasing the difference between systems and goals. For starters, my life requires a lot of mental energy. Today I will write 2 comics, a blog post, and a chapter of this book. I will work through some complicated real estate and trust issues, finish some legal work for the startup, do some quality testing, and still make time for family. The key to my doing that many things is that I eat right, exercise daily, and have lots of control over my schedule, which allows me to match my tasks with my mental state. Later today, when I'm mentally spent, I'll do a few hours of mindless drawing for the comics I already roughed out. So the first part of my system involves managing my mental and physical states so I can do more things with the right kind of energy. Another big part of my system involves generating lots of opportunities for luck to find me and taking the sort of risks that will allow me to come out ahead even if the project fails. CalendarTree fits that model perfectly. No matter how well the business actually does, I will come out of it with a detailed understanding of the startup process, a new network of highly capable contacts, a wealth of new knowledge in 6 areas, and about 75 new jokes for Dilbert. No one can predict how a startup will go after launch. The only thing I know for sure is that my partners and I plan to come out ahead. Every time we add new skills and broaden our network of contacts, our market value increases. Chapter 36. Voice Update 3. The nurses rolled me into the operating room on a gurney. I was already drugged up with stress-reducing medicines that were working wonders. I couldn't have been happier as the anesthesiologist asked me to count backward from 100. I made it to 98. It felt like dying happy. The recovery period was wretched. I choked on nearly everything I tried to swallow, and the situation lasted months. I could whisper because that doesn't involve the vocal cords, but my vocal cords might have been on the moon as far as my brain was concerned. They weren't talking to each other. Luckily, cartooning doesn't require speaking. I was back to work in a few days once the brain fog of surgery lifted. And I waited. Dr. Burke told me that nerves regenerate at a very predictable rate. In 3.5 months, if the surgery worked, the nerves would make their first full connection between my brain and my vocal cords. And after that, it might take a year to speak in a truly normal way. And that was only if the surgery worked. I often tried to speak during those months just to see what would happen. But indeed, my brain was no longer communicating with my vocal cords. It was an odd feeling. So I whispered when I was at home, wrote notes when I was in noisy environments, choked on everything that went down my throat, and waited. I also repeated my affirmations in my head, if for no other reason than to prop up my optimism. I, Scott Adams, will speak perfectly. 3.5 months after the surgery, almost to the day, Shelley stood in our living room and stared at me with disbelief. She said, "You just talked." And indeed, I had. It wasn't much of a voice. It was weak and breathy, and I couldn't sustain it beyond a few words at a time. But right on schedule, my brain and my vocal cords were becoming reacquainted. It wasn't success. It was just a start. I had months to go before knowing if the surgery had worked in any meaningful way. And I was worlds away from fulfilling my affirmation of speaking perfectly. But it was something. It was a lot. I cried. In the months that followed, my voice steadily improved. The dropping of syllables that defines spasmodic dysphonia was 100% gone, but my voice was weak, uneven, and sometimes hoarse. Luckily, these were more fixable problems given time and practice. And by that point, I was quite knowledgeable about proper voice technique, thanks to my many hours of voice therapy while I was searching for a cure. Interestingly, my brain was no longer practiced in vocal fluency. Long after my vocal cords were functioning normally, I had trouble forming coherent sentences. Speaking fluently in full sentences was something I hadn't done for nearly 4 years. But over time, my fluency returned too. Today, several years after the surgery, I can't say I've achieved my affirmation of speaking perfectly, if such a thing even exists. I had a weak and nasally voice before I ever got spasmodic dysphonia, so after surgery that seemed like the realistic upper limit for my recovery. And for most of my life, people couldn't hear me over crowd noise because my tone seemed to blend exactly with the background. For me, getting back to normal meant getting back to a crappy voice. That would have felt like success. To my surprise, that's not exactly what happened. Thanks largely to all of my voice training before the operation and what Dr. Burke hypothesized might have been a latent spasmodic dysphonia all my life, I ended up with a far more functional voice than ever before. I have no problem projecting in noisy environments, and since much of life is noisy, that is a big, big improvement. I still get a bit hoarse after exercise, and I'll never have a radio-quality voice. So, aesthetically, my voice remains less than ideal. But functionally, my voice is indeed perfect. I have escaped from my prison cell of silence, and life has never been more enjoyable or more satisfying. But there's one more thing I need to do, if you recall, or perhaps a few more things. I wasn't planning a simple escape from my voice prison. I promised myself that if I escaped, I would free the other inmates, kill the warden, and burn down the prison. That was one of my big motivations for this book. I wrote it, in part, for some poor soul in the middle of nowhere who has lost his voice to spasmodic dysphonia, and with it, all enjoyment of life. It's also for anyone who has an unsolvable problem, health-wise or otherwise. If you think your odds of solving your problem are bad, don't rule out the possibility that what is really happening is that you are bad at estimating odds. Chapter 37. A final note about affirmations. I know from experience that those listening to this book will be disproportionately interested in my stories about affirmations. I'm sure I will be proclaimed a witch or a moron or both. So let me answer those inevitable objections in advance. When I speak of affirmations these days, I try to say as clearly as possible that they appear to have a beneficial value. The reality is that if affirmations somehow steered the universe like magic, science probably would have discovered that force by now. I don't foresee the day when affirmations get scientific backing, at least not in the sense of testing for the existence of magic or psychic powers. I think we can all agree that affirmations are a phenomenon of the mind and belong in the domain of psychology and perception. Viewed in that light, one can imagine that doing affirmations might have a predictable impact on the brain, perhaps in terms of focus or motivation or any number of chemical reactions. Those reactions would, one assumes, be either beneficial or harmful to the pursuit of success. So in one sense, affirmations are no more special than any form of positive thinking, prayers, visualization, chanting, or the like. That said, I can tell you that in my case, affirmations appear to have more power than one might expect from positive thinking. The illusion is that the world itself is changing to satisfy the affirmations. Allow me to offer some explanations of why affirmations appear to be influencing more than just the person doing them. The most obvious explanation for the apparent power of affirmations is selective memory. There is plenty of science to support the idea that we humans tend to remember the things we want to remember and forget the things we'd rather forget. With affirmations, one might expect to remember the coincidental good luck and forget the bad luck. The result of that selective remembering gives us the incorrect impression that affirmations work more often than you might reasonably expect from chance alone. Another perfectly good explanation of the apparent power of affirmations is that people who report success with it are liars, with no more credibility than the people who report being abducted by aliens. In my case, I know I didn't lie about my experiences, but you have no way to be sure I'm telling the truth. False memory is another possible explanation for why affirmations appear to work. Perhaps we remember victories that weren't so amazing in reality, or we remember normal events as being huge coincidences. False memories are so common that you've certainly experienced them. For example, you might remember a childhood event in some detail and learn later that it happened to your sibling, not you. Humans form false memories quite easily, so that has to be one potential explanation of why affirmations appear to work. Another possible reason that affirmations appear to work is that optimists tend to notice opportunities that pessimists miss. A person who diligently writes affirmations day after day is the very definition of an optimist, even if only by actions. Any form of positive thinking, prayer, or the like would presumably put a person in a more optimistic mindset. And because optimists have been shown in studies to notice more opportunities than pessimists, the result can look like luck. Studies show that you need not be a natural-born optimist to get the benefits of better perception. You can train yourself to act like an optimist, and writing affirmations is probably good training, so that you get the same benefits as natural optimists when it comes to noticing opportunities. Whether you are a born optimist or you become one through affirmations, prayer, or positive thinking, you end up with several advantages that make it easier for luck to find you. Optimists notice more opportunities, have more energy because of their imagined future successes, and take more risks. Optimists make themselves an easy target for luck to find them. Another explanation for the apparent power of affirmations might be that we have the causation wrong. Perhaps only the people who know deep down that they have the right stuff to succeed will even bother doing affirmations. In my case, it means that somewhere in my mind, before I had written my first book, my subconscious somehow knew I had the talent to write a proper book, despite having no relevant writing experience or training. That explanation sounds reasonable to me, but it still means affirmations are useful, just in a different way than you might imagine. Under this explanation of the power of affirmations, they act as a sort of message from your subconscious to your rational mind, telling you that you have the right stuff, even if your common sense argues otherwise. This would be useful for people who have real talent but don't believe in it. Surely there are a lot of people in that camp. Another possible explanation for the apparent power of affirmations is that our tiny human brains have not evolved to the point where they can give us an accurate impression of our reality. Instead, our little brains create illusions that have survival benefits and some sort of internal consistency, nothing more. We know the brain creates illusions because there are so many competing religions in the world. Assuming you pick the right religion, all of those other poor souls are living in a deep illusion. Your neighbor might think he remembers his previous life, while you think you saw God during your heart bypass surgery. You can't both be right, but you could both be wrong, and both of you might be experiencing delusions of reality that somehow don't kill you. The point is that affirmations might have a perfectly sensible scientific explanation that involves anything from multiple universes to quantum strangeness or anything else that baffles our tiny brains and causes us to invent delusions to compensate for our feelings of uncertainty. To put it in simpler terms, affirmations might work for perfectly logical reasons our brains aren't equipped to understand. If you've read my blog, you know I'm fascinated by the possibility that we humans are nothing but holograms living in a computer simulation. It sounds ludicrous when you first hear the idea, but the math is oddly compelling. Consider what we humans would do 1,000 years from now if we knew an asteroid was heading our way and there was no escape. I think we'd upload our personalities to computers, perhaps with our DNA information as part of the code, and launch the computers into space so our culture, memories, and minds could live forever. Now for the math. If you pick any point in time, there will be infinitely more time transpiring after that time than before, assuming the Big Bang marks the start of time. So if you believe humans will someday be on the brink of extinction for any reason, there is a vastly greater chance we are already the simulations left behind. Some have argued that the universe is too young for the hologram scenario to have played out. But if we are holograms, the age of the universe as we perceive it is nothing but a variable from the programmer. The real age could be trillions of years. It's a fun thought experiment, but I know you don't buy into it. I only include it for completeness. If we are indeed nothing but computer-generated entities, affirmations could be nothing more than an unremarkable bit of programming code. I'll reiterate that I have no objective information to suggest that affirmations worked for me, or that they might work for you. And please don't email me to ask for the detailed instructions on affirmations so you can do it right. I've gotten hundreds of those emails already, and I always say some version of, I don't know. But for what it is worth, I don't think affirmations are sensitive to exactly how many times you write them, whether you use a keyboard or a pen, whether you throw away the paper you wrote on, how many weeks you do them for, or any other detail. I can't imagine the process of affirmations, if it works at all, is sensitive to the little details. I think a deep and consistent focus on what you want is all that is required. But that's just my gut feeling. You might see an inconsistency between affirmations and the theme of this book, specifically the parts where I say goals are for losers and systems are for winners. Affirmations look a lot like focusing on goals. But I would argue that doing affirmations is a system that helps you focus, boosts your optimism and energy, and perhaps validates the talent and drive that your subconscious always knew you had. If you plan to try affirmations, I recommend keeping your objectives broad enough to allow some luck. It's probably better to affirm future wealth than to try to win a specific lottery. Humans will always think in terms of goals. Our brains are wired that way. But goals make sense only if you also have a system that moves you in the right direction. So what do I believe about affirmations? I believe I tried affirmations on a number of occasions, and the results that I remember, or think I remember, appear to be borderline miraculous. To me, affirmations are an ongoing mystery. All I know for sure is that I've never heard of anyone being harmed, emotionally or otherwise, by affirmations. I tried affirmations out of curiosity and because they were free. I didn't need a better reason. Now you know what I know. Chapter 38. Summary. I've covered a lot of topics in this book, and I thought it would be helpful to provide a summary to wrap it all up. Keep in mind that if you skipped to the end of the book to listen to this section, it will seem extraordinarily unpersuasive out of context. The model for success I described here looks roughly like this. Focus on your diet first and get that right so you have enough energy to want to exercise. Exercise will further improve your energy, and that in turn will make you more productive, more creative, more positive, more socially desirable, and more able to handle life's little bumps. Once you optimize your personal energy, all you need for success is luck. You can't directly control luck, but you can move from strategies with bad odds to strategies with good odds. For example, learning multiple skills makes your odds of success dramatically higher than learning one skill. If you learn to control your ego, you can pick strategies that scare off the people who fear embarrassment, thus allowing you to compete against a smaller field. And if you stay in the game long enough, luck has a better chance of finding you. Avoid career traps such as pursuing jobs that require you to sell your limited supply of time while preparing you for nothing better. Happiness is the only useful goal in life. Unless you are a sociopath, your own happiness will depend on being good to others. And happiness tends to happen naturally whenever you have good health, resources, and a flexible schedule. Get your health right first. Acquire resources and new skills through hard work, and look for an opportunity that gives you a flexible schedule someday. Some skills are more important than others, and you should acquire as many of those key skills as possible, including public speaking, business writing, a working understanding of the psychology of persuasion, an understanding of basic technology concepts, social skills, proper voice technique, good grammar, and basic accounting. Develop a habit of simplifying. Learn how to make small talk with strangers, and learn how to avoid being an asshole. If you get that stuff right, and almost anyone can, you will be hard to stop. It might help some if you think of yourself as moist robots and not skin bags full of magic and mystery. If you control the inputs, you can determine the outcomes, give or take some luck. Eat right, exercise, think positively, learn as much as possible, and stay out of jail, and good things can happen. Look for patterns in every part of life, from diet to exercise to any component of success. Try to find scientific backing for your observed patterns, and use yourself as a laboratory to see if the patterns hold for you. Most important, understand that goals are for losers, and systems are for winners. People who seem to have good luck are often the people who have a system that allows luck to find them. I've laid out some systems in this book that seem to work for me. Your experience will differ, but it always helps to be thinking in terms of systems and not goals. And always remember that failure is your friend. It is the raw material of success. Invite it in. Learn from it, and don't let it leave until you pick its pocket. That's a system. The end. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, Kind of the Story of My Life, by Scott Adams. Copyright 2013 by Scott Adams, Inc. Performed by Patrick Lawler. Directed by Kevin Klempel. Performance copyright 2013 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. Recorded by arrangement with Portfolio, a member of Penguin Group USA, LLC. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.